كلام يا دنيا بلاش تصحي على فين يا موج الشوق ميودي.
Good morning everyone, and welcome to One Land, Many Voices on commercial-free, listener-supported KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. My name is Ned Roche, and this morning I'll be doing the show without Zaha, my awesome co-host, who will be here in spirit as we talk about the rapidly growing grassroots global campaign known as Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS. Though nonviolent action has always been a part of Palestinian resistance, even as far back as the first organized Zionist immigration to Palestine, BDS is perhaps the broadest and most organized expression of nonviolent resistance to Israeli colonial policies and human rights abuses. Initiated by Palestinian civil society in 2005, its aim is to have people of conscience around the world apply moral, legal, and political pressure on the Israeli government until it complies with international law and internationally recognized human rights. A groundbreaking victory for the BDS campaign occurred in December when the American Studies Association, the nation's largest association of professors devoted to the study of American culture and history, overwhelmingly voted to endorse BDS. As a result of the vote, ASA members have been savaged in the mainstream press, attacked by Israeli government officials, and smeared as anti-Semites. Portland State University President Vim Vivel is among those who condemn the ASA. In a press release, Vivel states, quote, "Even if a nation's politics or policies were abhorrent, it would be extremely rare for an academic boycott to be appropriate or useful. In the case of Israel, while reasonable people can certainly debate the merits of any number of specific policies and programs, the totality of the practices and beliefs of the country does not even come close to meriting a boycott. Indeed, the ASA action has encouraged me to strengthen my pursuit of academic exchanges between Portland State University and Israeli institutions," end quote. One Land, Many Voices attempted to get President Vivel on the program today, but his office declined our invitation for an interview. However, joining us this morning to discuss the ASA vote and academic boycott of Israel are two remarkable guests, Omar Barghouti and Chandan Reddy. Omar Barghouti is the founding member of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel and author of BDS, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights. He'll be joining us from occupied Palestine. Chandan Reddy is a professor at the University of Washington, specializing in critical race theory and globalization studies. He's active in the American Studies Association and will discuss the recent ASA resolution calling for the boycott of Israeli academic institutions. We begin with Omar Barghouti. Welcome to One Land, Many Voices, Omar. We are thrilled to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Omar, give us some background here. Tell us about the academic and cultural boycott of Israel, how it began, what an academic boycott looks like, and how the campaign coordinates with people and organizations around the world.
The academic and cultural boycott of Israel had its roots well before PACBI, the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, was launched in 2004. For many years, Palestinian academics, British academics, other academics have called for various measures against Israeli universities because of their deep complicity at all levels in Israel's regime of occupation, colonialism, and apartheid against the Palestinian people. But in 2004, a group of Palestinian academics and cultural workers got together and launched the call for academic cultural boycott. This call differs quite a lot, although it's inspired by the South African call for boycott. It differs from it quite a lot. In South Africa, the academic and cultural boycott call was a blanket call against every single academic and cultural worker, not just institutions. In the Palestinian case, we call only for boycotting the institutions in Israel that are complicit in the regime of human rights violations, not individual academics or artists or writers and so on. So to answer the second part, how a boycott would work, it would entail cutting links with all Israeli academic institutions and cultural institutions. So we're asking American academics in this case not to deal with Israeli universities and research centers. Dealing with Israeli academics as individuals, if there's no institutional link, is not boycottable. That's not something that the boycott covers. But we ask for a full severance of connections with all Israeli academic institutions. How we work around the world is we have a network of supporters, of partners around the world. In the United States, there's a U.S. campaign for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel, which is our most important partner in that area. And they have done an amazing job working with academics who are members of the ASA and other academic associations, preparing the ground for years sometimes to get to the point of a vote that supports a full academic boycott of Israel. But we also have partners in South Africa, in Britain, in Norway, in India, in many countries around the world.
And what do you say to critics who claim that boycotting Israeli academic and cultural institutions in fact stifles free speech and expression and actually may hinder the political change you seek in Israel itself?
It's strange for a country that stifles all rights, that suppresses all rights of the Palestinian people, to mention academic freedom. Israel has for decades suppressed Palestinian academic freedom, often quite violently. In 2008-2009, during the attack on Gaza, Israel bombed with F-16 bombers the Islamic University in Gaza, and several buildings were damaged, some completely damaged. Israel also bombed schools, including a UN school. Palestinian academics in the occupied West Bank are often denied access to their schools and universities. During the first Palestinian uprising or intifada between 1987 and 1993, Israel shut down Palestinian academic institutions entirely, sometimes for years on end. Bir Zeit University, for example, was shut down for four consecutive years. All Palestinian schools were shut down, and eventually all kindergartens. Palestinian education during that period was deemed illegitimate, illegal, and it was criminalized. A Palestinian child holding a textbook was considered in violation of a military order banning education. So Palestinian education went underground, and Israel used to boast that they caught a clandestine class taught by some Bir Zeit academic, let's say, at a YMCA or in the basement of a home somewhere, without any sense of irony that they caught a clandestine class. So Israel has systematically suppressed academic freedom for Palestinians. Now, still, even ignoring this issue, the claim that the Palestinian call for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel, which the ASA has supported, would infringe academic freedom, misses the point entirely. We're not calling for any suppression of individual academic freedom. Israeli academics under the boycott would still be able to teach, do research, publish, participate in conferences around the world, and so on. All what we're calling for is severing institutional links with Israeli universities. So people making this argument are conflating academic privilege with academic freedom. It's privileges that they're talking about, and most importantly, it's the privilege of Israeli academic institutions to continue their deeply complicit role in Israel's regime of occupation and apartheid without censure, without any punitive measures taken against them. The last point I want to make is that some of those same critics are now accusing the Palestinian academic boycott of Israel and its supporters of suppressing academic freedom are the same people who, in the 80s, supported a full academic boycott of South Africa, including of South African academics. The hypocrisy is reaching a new level, as we can see. But going back to the quote from the president of the Portland State University that you started with, we're not surprised at all that Israel and its lobby groups managed to summon tens of herd-like academic administrators in the U.S. and asked them to go repeat Parrot party line that was dictated by Israel's lobby to them. They all repeated the same argument without a sense of shame for them as academics to even try to be creative or intellectual in expressing their own views of this boycott. They simply repeated the lobby line in attacking the ASA and academic boycott of Israel. But this is what they did also during the South African academic boycott. Many of the administrators of American universities stood against divestment from apartheid, against an academic boycott of South Africa, until they were compelled to heed the opinions of a majority of academics in their universities, and a lot of student activism pressured them into eventually accepting divestment and academic boycott of apartheid South Africa. Similarly, without a grassroots movement, as we're seeing being built in the U.S. now, those same academic administrators will not accept the academic boycott of Israel easily.
Speaking of the connection that you bring up between South Africa and Israel, in your recent op-ed in the Sunday New York Times, you wrote, and I quote, "Would justice and equal rights for all really destroy Israel? Did equality destroy the American South or South Africa? Certainly, it destroyed the discriminatory racial order that had prevailed in both places, but it did not destroy the people or the country. Likewise, only Israel's unjust order is threatened by boycotts, divestment, and sanctions," end quote. It seems that the heart of what you're getting at is this notion of Israel as a Jewish state, and whether in an age where we recognize the abhorrence of racial discrimination, an ethno-religious state can be compatible with human rights. Would you speak a little bit, Omar, about the BDS campaign and whether it has set out a political program for what it hopes to see in place of the current Israeli state structure?
Sure. The BDS movement started with the BDS call of 2005, as you mentioned in the introduction, which was launched by the absolute majority in Palestinian society, including all political parties, all trade union federations, all mass movements, union of women, of workers, of teachers, of writers, and farmers, and so on and so forth. So the absolute majority got together and launched this call, which basically states that without ending Israel's occupation, ending Israel's system of racial discrimination against its own citizens who are Palestinian, the indigenous Palestinians inside Israel, and without ending Israel's denial of our refugees' rights to return to the homes and lands from which they were ethnically cleansed during Israel's Nakba against the Palestinians, that's the 1948 systematic ethnic cleansing of the majority of the Palestinian indigenous population, without ending those three injustices, we cannot exercise our inalienable UN-stipulated right to self-determination. So that's what BDS aims to end, Israel's unjust order against the Palestinian people. Israel is premised, it's founded on racist foundations. It is an ethnocratic state that's exclusionary by its very nature. It insists on excluding non-Jews, including citizens who are not non-Jews, from the full set of rights. So it has a two-tiered system, one for its Jewish citizens, and in fact for any person around the world, and another for its citizens who are not Jewish, let alone the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, including in Jerusalem, who are not even citizens. So they're even a third tier. So Israel meets the UN definition of apartheid. It's not just an occupation. It's not just a colonial power. It is also guilty of the crime of apartheid because it has more than 50 racist laws that discriminate between its Jewish and non-Jewish citizens. It does not mean that Israel is identical to South Africa. It's not. But being an apartheid state does not mean that you have to be identical to South Africa. You have to have a family resemblance to the crimes that were committed in South Africa, to the same racist crimes that were committed in the U.S. South, during the civil rights movement. We did not call it apartheid then because the UN convention that developed the definition of apartheid was not in existence at the time. It came much later in 1973. But what you had in the U.S. was indeed an apartheid system, and Israel is guilty of that now. So BDS aims to end all this injustice and to achieve Palestinian freedom, justice, and equal rights.
And even though Israel has one of the most powerful militaries in the world, has a relatively strong economy, and is supported by the U.S. economically, militarily, and diplomatically, the price of its occupation, as you're describing it, and colonization and repression, that price tag for Israel is rising. An Israeli financial analyst recently concluded that BDS was in part responsible for the recent devaluation of the Israeli shekel. So considering the huge power imbalance between Israel and the Palestinians, how does it work that a nonviolent human rights strategy like BDS can have such impact?
Israel as an oppressor system was not designed to face such nonviolent challenges that are based on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and international law. Israel is indeed one of the most powerful armies in the world. It has a massive nuclear weapons arsenal. However, it does not know how to effectively suppress a nonviolent movement like ours. As one Israeli general said in the context of suppressing popular resistance against the wall in Belaim, a village in the West Bank, he said, "We don't do Gandhi very well." Indeed, we found that out during those 8 years of BDS activism that Israel does not know how best to face such a movement. It has tried every trick in the book: intimidation, bullying, smearing, using the anti-Semitism smear, and so on, but nothing worked. BDS kept intensifying, spreading at a very high rate, especially in the last couple of years, and Israel has failed in most of those confrontations. Ultimately, it's resorting to what we call lawfare, legal warfare against BDS. Yesterday, the Israeli government held a secret meeting for most of the ministers and the head of the intelligence services. And the whole purpose of that meeting was to develop a strategy to combat BDS. Some of the ideas that were leaked to the Israeli media include allocating 100 million Israeli shekels, which is something like $30 million, to combat BDS, intensifying intelligence gathering in Western countries by the Mossad, by the Israeli intelligence, against BDS organizations and activists, and all sorts of legal challenges to BDS, including going to Congress or the Canadian Parliament or the Australian Parliament, trying to pass bills and pass laws that would criminalize BDS. The problem Israel will face and is facing now in the U.S. because they've already started presenting a bill in Congress to suppress BDS. The problem they're facing is that this flies in the face of the U.S. Constitution. It's a direct violation of the First Amendment to defund an organization like the ASA simply because it practiced its right to support a nonviolent tactic like a boycott of the academic institutions of Israel because they're involved in human rights violations. So this violates the First Amendment, and this is actually mobilizing liberal America against this suppression. So even those in the U.S. who are not supportive of BDS are now up in arms against this bill that Israel and its lobby are pushing in Congress, because they think that this is a slippery slope and they will not accept such a blatant violation of the First Amendment. Now, in recent weeks, Israel has faced a very, very serious challenge from BDS-related measures. The second largest Dutch pension fund, PGGM, which is a $200 billion fund, divested from all Israeli banks involved in the occupied territories. The German government has informed Israel that it will exclude from any scientific cooperation agreements or research grants any Israeli entity that is operating in the occupied Palestinian territory. The Norwegian pension fund, the absolute largest in the world, just blacklisted two large Israeli real estate companies because of their involvement in settlements. The largest Danish bank, Danske Bank, blacklisted Hapoalim, a very large Israeli bank, because it's involved in the occupied territories. And last year, of course, four academic associations in the U.S. passed academic boycott. Stephen Hawking, the greatest scientist alive, boycotted an Israeli conference. The Teachers Union of Ireland also joined the academic boycott of Israel. And several student councils across U.S. campuses have succeeded in passing divestment resolutions against U.S. companies involved in the Israeli occupation and human rights violations. So this is a movement that's growing through winning hearts and minds, through its moral power of persuasion and nothing else. And Israel does not have the means, the capacity, the weapons, if you will, that can counter this moral attack, if you will.
Yeah, it seems that Israel is increasingly stuck trying to justify the unjustifiable. So it's been almost 10 years now.
They think that if...
Go ahead.
If a stick doesn't work, then they resort to a bigger stick.
Right. So it's been 8.5 or so years since the Palestinian civil society call for BDS against Israel took place. And BDS, as you're describing it, seems to be succeeding where negotiations, arms, and even other forms of nonviolent resistance have failed. What's your assessment of the movement's achievements to date? And more importantly, perhaps, what are its biggest challenges ahead?
I mentioned some of the most important successes. I would just like to add one very important. In December 2012, the ANC, the African National Congress, the ruling party of South Africa, endorsed BDS at its national conference. This was a historic decision for us, coming from South Africa, from the ANC, no less, that led the anti-apartheid struggle. This is an extremely important development for the BDS movement. So it's not just Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Ronny Castros, who was a minister in the first Mandela government, but now the ANC itself endorsing BDS. And we're very proud of the massive support we have in South Africa and among trade unions in Brazil, India, Turkey, Sweden, Britain, and elsewhere. The main challenge we're facing is the legal challenge, that Israel is relying on its massive power in the U.S. Congress, in the Canadian Parliament, the Australian Parliament, and so on, to criminalize BDS. This is the biggest challenge. After their failure, their utter failure, with the so-called Brand Israel campaign, which was launched also in 2005 to combat BDS, sending Israeli artists, writers, musicians, and dancers around the world to show, as they say, Israel's prettier face, to whitewash Israel's crimes against the Palestinians. This campaign has failed, the Brand Israel campaign. So now they're resorting to legal warfare against BDS and using their political muscle, especially in Congress, to suppress the movement through legal repression means.
Right. We see that in state legislatures as well, where bills are being introduced to criminalize boycott or the kinds of actions the ASA just took. You've mentioned a number of times the comparison between South Africa and Israel. What do you say to people that continually sing the song that, yeah, it worked in South Africa, but the U.S. connection to South Africa was nothing compared to how in bed the United States is currently with Israel, and the U.S. is not going to roll over very easily, and therefore BDS has such an uphill battle?
We're not underestimating the challenge ahead. We understand very much the organic relationship between the 1% in the U.S. and the State of Israel. Israel is very good for business if you're in the military, weapons business, homeland security business. It's good for the 1% in the U.S. because Israel wages wars every couple of years, promoting U.S. latest weaponry, testing, field testing U.S. weapons on Palestinian civilians, Lebanese civilians, and others. So Israel is, in a way, very good for the death business in the U.S. But it's not good for the 99%. Those billions of dollars spent on Israel and all endless wars by the U.S. in the Middle East would much better be spent on job creation, on the environment, on education, on healthcare in the United States, where those services are crumbling. Anyone who visits the U.S. today, like I did, and who lived there many years before, were shocked at what's happening with the U.S. at all levels of services. When public schools are being shut down in the U.S., while it can afford to spend billions on warmongering and waging wars against Palestinians, Lebanese, Pakistanis, Afghanis, Iraqis, you name it, there's something deeply, deeply wrong. And I think that more and more in the U.S. public are realizing this. So despite the strong organic relationship between Israel as a regime of oppression and empire, the U.S. empire, the establishment, not the people, but the establishment, despite those strong links, we think an increasing number of Americans are realizing that Israel has become a burden, not an asset, and that it is time to take action against its criminal impunity. When four academic associations in the U.S. in 1 year pass full academic boycott of Israel, this argument that, you know, you're facing an uphill battle, it's not really possible in the foreseeable future, collapses. I mean, this argument has been shattered by the ASA and by our other partners in the Asian American Studies Association, the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association, and so on. Increasingly, we're hearing brave Jewish voices, like Jewish Voice for Peace and other Jewish groups, that are challenging the attempt by Israel to monopolize Jewish voice and to speak on behalf of Jewish communities worldwide. They're challenging AIPAC, and they're telling it, you do not speak for us, you do not represent us. We stand for justice, we stand for equal rights for all people. We're seeing the battlefield being changed before our eyes. So the argument is, the argument that...
Unfortunately, we lost our connection with Omar Barghouti, but we're back online again. Omar, in conclusion, are there any comments you would like to share with our audience?
Yes, I think that we are very inspired by ASA and by what many, many Americans across the country have done in support of the BDS movement. We're very proud of our partners in the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, Jewish Voice for Peace, AFSC, Adala New York, and many, many other groups across the country who are doing an amazing job against all odds, against intimidation and bullying by the Israel lobby. And I think they're changing the discourse and they're changing the reality before our eyes. What seemed at one point impossible to conquer, the Israeli-U.S. kind of alliance is now very much conquerable, and it looks much more real because of those efforts. We rely on peace-loving, conscientious people in the United States to help end the links of complicity between the U.S. and Israel. And doing that is not just good for the Palestinians, it's also good for the 99% in the U.S.
You're listening to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. We've been speaking with Omar Barghouti, one of the founders and leaders of the BDS movement. Thank you so much, Omar, for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Ned. Take care.
When we return, we continue this important discussion with Chandan Reddy of the American Studies Association, a group of American Studies professors who recently overwhelmingly passed a resolution boycotting Israeli academic institutions.
Brother died young, he was was all alone. The drones exploded, burned everything we owned. The moans of women, groans have grown. The tears and woes from broken bones. These stolen homes, living our chromosomes. See, we never forget, Nakba, we mourn. Imagine being torn from where you were born. It's wrong, living in fear for so long, but with nowhere to go. I'm fighting F-16s, but throwing stones at my foes. I sit back and relax and reminisce on the past. Drinking blood, choking gas through the bullets that pass. Rockets blast, broken glass with a house full of ash. Spills of babies, see their bodies collapse, and that's that. Their bodies in caskets, flowers in baskets. They're murdering masses, we trapped with no passes. We choking on gases, but the gas is still sprayed. My oxygen fades, still trapped in a cage. But the pain never fades, see the war is eternal. Imagine Era Ben Frank writing her journals. Imagine Arab babies getting tossed in infernos. The Holocaust of Palestine, what a vicious circle. White phosphorus burns, you ask why we weep. Rest is for the guilty, feel me, I never sleep. My anger runs deep and my emotions are numb. So a middle finger to that soldier holding that gun.
Dear Lord, I know that you cry sometimes. Tears over Palestine. I'm trying to make it in this cold world, but there's more war and it's so hard up in Palestine.
Tears over Palestine.
I've seen so many of my friends, they passed and we're gone before they time. I'm trying to make it in this cold world, but there's more war and it's so hard up in Palestine.
Tears over Palestine.
Can't believe I lost my bro, he was only 9. Feelings of pain can't define, man, it blows my mind. Maybe I'm insane, but I'm trying to be sane. The flame burns in my veins, fire can't be tamed. So I sit and reminisce on the times of bliss, of the years we enjoyed, though the war persists. Still resist with a stone in my fist. The Gaza Strip, West Bank, I give my mama a kiss before I flip. Man, it's thrilling and killing me, ain't no drug is healing me. His murder is haunting, and these chemicals ripping me. Historical narration that will make the blind see. Broken dreams, metal war machines, any zombies. Xanax tabs, Ambien pills to keep us asleep. While wicked troops quick to move and kill us like sheep. In every town that you see, the blood spill in the streets. We was willing for peace, but now a militant fleet. The millions I see stuck up in refugee camps. The water ends in enemies' hands on settlement land. And all the death in my fam, we like the Kennedy clan. I would forgive if I could just clear my memory bank. Can't forget my brother that passed, I'll see him in paradise. I hope to see a killer's corpse eaten by parasites. We martyrs, but they depict us as villains. And my brother represents the Palestinian children.
Dear Lord, I know that you cry sometimes. Tears over Palestine. I'm trying to make it in this cold world, but there's more war and it's so hard up in Palestine.
Tears over Palestine.
I've seen so many of my friends, they passed and we're gone before they time. I'm trying to make it in this cold world, but there's more war and it's so hard up in Palestine.
Tears over Palestine.
Sometimes tears over Palestine. I'm trying to make it in this cold world, but there's more war and it's so hard up in Palestine.
Tears over Palestine.
I've seen so many of my friends, they passed and we're gone before they time. I'm trying to make it in this cold world, but there's more war and it's so hard up in Palestine.
Tears over Palestine.
You're listening to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO 90.7 FM. It's now my pleasure to bring into this discussion Dr. Chandan Reddy from the University of Washington, Professor of Critical Race Theory, Sexuality and Queer Studies, Globalization Studies, and Asian American Cultural Studies. Chandan is active in the American Studies Association and supportive of the recent ASA resolution calling for the boycott of Israeli academic institutions. Welcome, Chandan, to One Land, Many Voices.
Thank you for having me.
The ASA was chartered in 1951 and is the nation's oldest and largest association devoted to the interdisciplinary study of American culture and history. Why did the ASA feel compelled to take a position on the Israel-Palestine conflict, and how important was the vote to boycott Israeli academic institutions?
The ASA took this position in some ways as an act that is consistent with other positions that it's taken throughout the history of the organization's existence. The organization is unique among academic organizations because it believes that structural constrictions to democratic life actually hinder and block our knowledge as well as our sense of social truths and social meaning. So the ASA, for example, participates in boycotts against non-union hotels to support the rights of workers and to make sure that workers' voices are a part of the knowledge that we produce and can hear from. During the Iraq War, the U.S. war in Iraq, the ASA took a position strongly against the war in Iraq, as well as remarked on the fact that the U.S. wars oftentimes disproportionately take their personnel from communities of color, as well as have devastating effects for working class communities that restrict those educational opportunities and hence, again, limit our knowledge of society. So the ASA has always taken policy positions wherever it's been important to suggest that there are structural infringements on democratic life and academic freedom. And when the Palestinian Civil Society Call came out in 2006, the ASA has been actively debating and discussing the academic and cultural boycott, and it decided that after much debate and discussion this year that it was time for the organization to endorse the boycott and take a stand for Palestinian academic freedom and Palestinian participation in academic culture.
But how do you respond to the criticism that what the ASA vote did was to actually stifle the free exchange of ideas between academic institutions and therefore is antithetical to free expression?
It's a really good question, and I think it's fair to imagine that might be the case. But if you look at all of the materials that the ASA has produced and has put out into the public sphere, we've been explicit that this is an act of solidarity with Palestinian peoples and Palestinian society, and particularly scholars and students. The boycott of academic Israeli institutions is an institutional boycott. It does not suppress the academic freedom of individual Israeli scholars. In fact, the ASA is inviting Israeli, Palestinian, and other Arab scholars to come to its next program to continue a conversation about politics in the region and how we can expand freedoms for every part of the region. Additionally, we recognize that there might be members in our organization who don't feel comfortable with participating in the academic boycott of the institutions, and so they can operate with their, they can act under their own conscience. So this maximizes academic freedom for scholars, which is what academic freedom is about, against institutional authority. And so that's why it's a very targeted activity, and it's within the parameters and especially the spirit of academic freedom.
Mm-hmm. Because the vote was based in large part on what the ASA calls the complicity of Israeli universities with the illegal military occupation of Palestine. So share with us, how are Israeli academic institutions complicit?
You know, it's a great question. It varies from institution to institution. One of the things that's unique about the Israeli intellectual system, compared, for example, to the United States, is that most of higher education institutions in Israel are federally funded almost entirely or with strong federal support. And so they're all linked by the federal government. That said, each institution has a different level of participation in the ongoing occupation of Palestine, as well as in the restriction of Palestinian rights. Some are actually built in occupied territory, as you know. Some have been recruiting grounds for military secret service and military personnel. Some have participated by having their engineering and their science divisions explicitly collaborate with IDF as well as Israeli military. Some restrict the freedom of speech of Palestinian students by outlawing and making illegal Palestinian cultural organizations on their campuses. So the variety of ways in which infringement occurs is numerous. And what we're saying is that because of this variety, one thing we know is that Israeli academic institutions are systematically a part of this problem.
What's been the response to the ASA vote at the University of Washington, your school? Has there been a response by the president of the UW similar to that of PSU's Vim Vival, who condemned the ASA vote, as I mentioned before, and promised to seek even more exchanges with Israeli institutions?
Right. The response of the University of Washington has, I think, been very reasonable and very tempered. I think that, again, like our organization, there are many faculty who are in support of the position of the ASA, and there's equally a number of faculty who believe that the position of the ASA, as much as they're critical of Israel, is not the way that they would like to express their criticism and their free speech. The president of the University of Washington has signed a letter that speaks against the ASA boycott, but has also been explicit about protecting faculty rights and faculty interests and in free speech and in faculty academic freedom to participate. So I say that it's very measured. Additionally, I just want to add that we have student organizations that have been collaborating with faculty to participate in a divestment program against Israeli corporations that in the occupied territories, and that happened before this vote. That was actually last spring, and that passed both the faculty levels and was able to be successfully lobbied by TAA Crafts. So the students have been fantastic in organizing against the occupation.
And how have you seen that student activism evolve over the past few years at the UW?
I think that one of the things that's really rich about the student activism that is a lesson for many of us is that it began with students that were concerned about sweatshop labor in Latin America and other parts of the globe, Bangladesh, where student apparel was being produced. And it produced a very successful, students produced a very successful movement against sweated labor and for making sure that the university took responsibility for the action, for the goods and products that had its name on it and that sold. After that student movement was successful, many of those students became concerned in other forms of systemic oppression, and some of them joined with Palestinian students, with students, Jewish students and members of the Jewish diaspora who were concerned about Israeli occupation. There were many students who independently were concerned in the region, and they all came together and built on the success of this first movement and started working on the movement for divestment in relation now to Israeli occupied areas. So I think that it's part and parcel of many movements of solidarity. I think one of the things that we've learned is that this boycott action is in the tradition of solidarity actions and hence is deeply legitimate as a form of political speech.
Would you be willing to share with us your own involvement and interest in this issue, your own journey through the Israel-Palestine conflict?
Thank you. I'd be happy to. I think that as someone who's part of the South Asian diaspora, I became deeply aware of the need for diasporic participation in these questions when I was a graduate student in New York. I was organizing with other gay and lesbian people of color, immigrants of color, on a variety of issues, including issues of sexuality in our home countries, as well as the ways in which U.S. military and other forms of military produce sexuality politics globally. And it was in that context that I met many Palestinian queers of color, for whom, of course, working on Palestine was central to their politics as queer people of color and as progressive people. And it became very clear to me that I had an ethical responsibility as a diasporic person collaborating with other members of diaspora to have knowledge of this region, to have knowledge of the linked histories of colonialism, of the linked histories of British occupation in our countries, and of our linked histories under as migrants of the United States, and our responsibility to participate in the struggle for Palestinian freedom. So I came to this really in a very personal journey with other Palestinian friends, in which I knew I had to have a response as a person of conscience and as someone whose friendships are with both Israeli, Jewish, and Palestinian members of diaspora.
And what were the conversations like at the ASA before the resolution was passed? There must have been an incredible divergence of opinion among the professors. Could you share some of the tensions, some of the strategies around the tension, and how ultimately there was a successful resolution overwhelmingly passed?
Right. I'd be happy to. Thanks for the question. There were really quite a variety of positions. I think one of the richest outcomes of this conversation and of this resolution is that even people who were against perhaps the endorsement of a academic boycott because they felt like even under the conditions under which the ASA was promoting that boycott, that it was not sufficient for them to participate in it reasonably. Even that voice, which was a smaller voice in the ASA, felt that they wanted to take a strong position against Israeli occupation. There were very few people in the conversation who said, I think that the boycott is wrong, as well as I think criticism of Israel is wrong. Everyone in the organization, I think, has the position that there it is extremely reasonable and it's extremely important to say right now that Israeli occupation is unviable, that the level of violence that Israel is inflicting on its Arab citizens is not viable, that what is going on currently, even in the academic sphere in Israel, is an infringement on Palestinian well-being and Palestinian voice. So what was really rich about, I think, the conversation is, as much as there was divergence about the boycott, it has made everyone take a position about the current situation on Israel, and there was a remarkable level of agreement at that level. In relationship to the boycott, the conversations were, again, diverse. Some believe that the boycott was an infringement on academic freedom, and there had to be a lot of debate about how to make it structured in a way that didn't do that. There were some that believed that the boycott needed to be more explicit about the U.S. involvement in the ongoing practice of occupation. The U.S., of course, is the largest donor to Israel foreign aid, and Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid, averaging about $3 billion a year annually since the 1980s. So people really wanted to see a more explicit discussion of the U.S. involvement and role, and why it is that we as U.S.-based people, citizens and immigrants and non-citizens alike who live in U.S. Society, need to take a strong position on this. There were some who also wanted to hear more from Palestinians, as well as more from Israeli members of society. There's a strong and active Israeli left that has been even more vocally critical of the occupation than even U.S. scholars have. And people really wanted to know how we could do the boycott in a manner that would support that left and recognize the active Israeli left and the active role of Israelis against occupation. So part of what's going to happen at the next meeting is a continuation of these divergent positions in a conversation, as well as getting these voices from the region to come to the ASA.
And how big and how influential is the ASA relative to all the professors and all the academic institutions in this country? How significant is this resolution?
It's a great question. It's hard to know empirically at this point. The ASA as a member organization is about 4,000 to 5,000 faculty, as well as community scholars and graduate students concerned in the, for the study of American culture. and debates about the history of the United States, both as a cultural and a political entity and system. The ASA is an interdisciplinary organization, so it has members from departments of history, departments of anthropology, departments of English and literature, film and media studies, as well as sociology, music, religion, and other areas. So I think that one of the ways in which we're seeing the impact of the organization is that interdisciplinary members are bringing the ASA resolution and position to their departments, and departments are having active discussions about this. So it's not just impacting the field of American studies, but it's impacting all of these allied fields in which our members are actively involved. It has sparked rich conversation and debate and disagreement from other organizations like the Association of the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors, as well as rich conversations among some of the biggest academic bodies like the Modern Language Association, the American Historical Association. So right now, I think the impact is quite pervasive. I think that there is a level of unreasonable opposition going on in the public sphere currently, and I'm thinking of legislation being introduced in New York State, in Maryland, in Pennsylvania, possibly California, at the U.S. Federal level, against the ASA resolution that's hyperbolic and reminiscent of McCarthy-era forms of political test that have brought the ASA decision out in public even more than we could have expected. And we're happy to be one organization that's hosting this conversation. But I think that the impact is going to be ongoing for a number of years, and we have to see where it lands.
Mm-hmm. And Chandan, as we wrap up this interview, are there any last thoughts or words that you'd like to share?
You know, I would say that the only last thought I would like to share is the ASA resolution is the culmination of conversations in the organization. And no matter where an individual stood, I think everyone felt that we had done a good job of reckoning with the conditions of Palestinian suffering and of U.S. participation in the ongoing history of that suffering. The boycott is very much important for an organization like the ASA that has supported movements for civil rights, in which boycotts are very important, as well as the South African Solidarity Movement. So I would say that the parting remark that I would like to give is whether or not people feel like the boycott was the best action, I think that's a genuinely debatable question. People have divergence of opinion. I think it's important that we all take a moment to reckon with the ongoing occupation and how best to respond to it.
You've been listening to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. We've been speaking with Dr. Chandan Reddy from the University of Washington. Thank you so much, Chandan. We appreciate that. And we also appreciate all of our listeners tuning in this morning to One Land, Many Voices. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia with Chris Andre.
صحيح على فين يا موج الشوق مودي والريح بحس
Thank you baby just wanna take a little time out. Do you? Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Oh, wait. Thank you.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's winter membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10 a.m. Coming up, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on the Radio Zine, members of the GI Coffeehouse Tour talk about what they do, the history of the GI Coffeehouse movement, the current state of the military, and what it means for service members and their families. At 11:30, Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher speaks with Sean DiCarlo of the Oregon Food Bank and David Bolton of the State of Oregon about hunger in Oregon, the food bank, and DEQ Foodstock, a variety music show this Saturday to raise funds for the Oregon Food Bank. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support in our winter membership drive. And don't forget, you can still become a member at kboo.fm when you click on Donate Today. Stay tuned.
Today is Friday, February 28, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. We have an extraordinary guest today, someone that if you use encryption or decryption, you are using something created by this person a long time ago, who has been in the world of encryption, decryption, writing code, and basically the foundation of hacking itself for a long, long time. Richard Stallman will be joining us. We've got just a couple of local notes from around Cascadia that you might want to know about. We're all set to report on Right to Dream 2, might want to rename itself Project Right 1.5 Dream 1.5, because the community wants to remain within a 1.5-mile radius of its current location. But Dan Salzman has pointed out that that's valuable real estate, that 1.5 radius. Meanwhile, getting set to report that Turns out that Ibrahim Mubarak was arrested last night under the Burnside Bridge with a massive cadre of police moving in on people who are camped out there. There's a video that shows all of it in very sharp detail. You can almost read the badge numbers if it weren't for the fact that the Portland police very often conceal their badge numbers. So that said, a right to dream too. Also, the Portland Association of Teachers has ratified the contract deal that averted an unprecedented walkout. And now that the union members gave the go-ahead on this negotiated settlement, I didn't say arm twisting, did I? No, I didn't. The deal now heads to the school board for votes tonight. This should be exciting. In the road from Damascus and imbroglio, Damascus, the town nearby, gets what it wants. And as the saying goes, sometimes karma is getting what you want and then getting stuck with it. After months of harsh controversy, the Oregon Senate finally approved a bill allowing property owners on the edge of Damascus to leave the city. And guess what? That's what they're doing. So now property owners within a half mile of another existing city can de-annex from Damascus, likely leading to many residents who qualify to annex into nearby Happy Valley. Maybe Right to Dream 2 can move to Damascus as it's gradually vacated. We have weather to get to. It's sunny today, but it won't be that way for very long. And I would much rather hear from Richard Stallman. So that said, and on that note, I want to greet one of the most extraordinary guests we've ever had on the show. Good morning, Richard. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, it's that morning here in
Good
Cambridge,
afternoon. Good day to you. Good day. Well,
hello. Can
yes.
you hear me?
Yes.
It's not morning here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's 1 p.m. But something more important, I have to correct the way you introduced me, because I did not write our encryption and decryption code. We have a program called the GNU Privacy Guard, or GPG, which is part of the GNU operating